Good evening, anarchists everywhere. I'm Ian Bone and welcome to Anarchism in the UK. Today's guest is Si Mitchell, filmmaker, activist, iconoclastic scourge of political correctness and resident of Brighton. Welcome, Si.
Yeah, hi, Ian.
Let's talk about your filmmaking career first. As Guerrilla Vision, you made three activist films, Big Rattle in Seattle, Capitol Hills and Crab Bites Wolf, and based around meetings of the World Bank and the World Trade Organization. How did you come to make those films in the first place?
Well, I guess around the end of the 90s, there was there were some activist filmmakers. Most notably, there was an organisation from Oxford called Undercurrents who were doing an activist-style monthly, I think it was monthly news bulletin. And there were various other people doing quite worthy films about issues and stuff that was going on, environmentalism, police activity, and so forth. And I think it sort of struck, well, when I say us, it struck sort of various individuals, but individually, that this was quite po-faced, and it was quite lecturing and sort of finger-wagging, and it always seemed a pity that, it wasn't rabble-rousing and it wasn't inspiring. And I guess the sort of what you like out of your cinema, or what I like out of my cinema, is that I like it to inspire me. And I met a character who's myself and him became the core of Guerrilla Vision, actually in Seattle. We went out there for the World Trade Organization conference in November 99. And I guess, we knew there was going to be a big fight and it was going to be exciting. So we sort of went...
You intended to make it, so...
Me and several thousand other people. And I met a character there called Leon, who had a camera that he had recently piked from the Hong Kong airport duty-free shop. He jumped over the counter and pulled it out of a cabinet while he was waiting for his aeroplane. So we had the camera, and actually we came by the microphone, I think courtesy of a Radio Shack that the security wasn't all out on in Seattle. And then we made the first film, Big Rattle in Seattle. Specifically, the idea was to wind people up, in a positive way, to get people to take to the streets. I mean, at the time, we were all quite excited by the anti-globalisation movement. Anarchism was on the up. Generally, the left was getting more active and more excitable. So we thought we'd fan the flames.
That must have turned into a much bigger riot than you thought, though, didn't it, Seattle?
Yeah, well, I think riot's probably a grander description for what happened in Seattle than what it was. It was a huge mobilisation of people, and it was really exciting. I remember at the time, though, a lot of the Americans going, "Oh, this is the beginning of something. This is the beginning of something," which upset a lot of the English anarchists and activists who were there, who were like, "Well, actually, some of us on the other side of the Atlantic have been working very hard in this sort of stuff for a long time." We'd also just recently had a big demonstration in the City of London on June 18th, which, had culminated in people getting inside the Stock Exchange, cleverly orchestrated action. This was a sort of the parting cry of Reclaim the Streets, which had some fairly good, exciting, positive run-ins with the state during the 2 years previous to that. So Seattle, the reason we knew Seattle was going to be big was because the Americans were so interested in what had been happening in Britain and in Europe, and they decided actually we'd like a bite of that apple ourselves.
You know, there's a full-length American feature film coming out.
Yeah, no, so I hear all-star cast with Andre 3000 and whatnot, yeah.
Are you watching out for any infringement of copyright?
Absolutely, man. The invoices are in.
So then you went on to do the... Am I right that the Washington, D.C. one was the next one, Capitol Hill?
We went, which was the following April, I think. So it was just several months later. And mainly, it was just to sort of galvanise what we'd done in Seattle. Because, we met each other in Seattle. We had a lot of fun anyway. I guess we were just moving along with a movement that was getting bigger and kind of exciting. And hands up, our carbon footprints were probably getting a little heavier in the sand. But yeah, we went to Washington DC because we've, you know, following the Seattle film, we had some ideas that we wanted to put into practice.
I take it you don't hold much still by a filmmaker's objectivity. You seem to be the only filmmaker I've come across who combines participation in a right with filming it.
Well, I think in the media, not just in filmmaking and documentary, but in journalism as a whole, I think objectivity, or this sort of myth of objectivity, is something that I find quite irritating. You know, the BBC will claim to have objectivity, but you know, by who they choose to interview, the questions they choose to ask, you know, the edits they make, the issues that they ignore, the debates they never have, you know, all these things are incredibly subjective. And it's a pretense, it's a farce to go, we're being objective just because we've got Paxo in a suit, you know, barking some irrelevant question at the Home Secretary. It's like, you know, the wider debate of why do we have to accept the system as it is? Why can't we overturn the whole apple cart and run down the street naked? You know, it's like, you know, it's not happening. So I guess to us, it was more honest to be subjective and to put our hands up and say, look, this is where we're coming from, you know, and we're honest about it, and we're subjective, and yeah, damn straight, man. What we made were propaganda films, and we wanted people to take to the streets.
Yeah, one of the quotes I've read about the three Guerrilla Vision films is, when you've seen all three, you will reach for a rock and head off to attack the nearest symbol of capitalist oppression. So that was the correct intent of the film.
Was that your quote?
That wasn't mine. No, I found that on the web. Like, that's a genuine quote. So perhaps you made it up.
Yeah, no, that's nice. Not everybody was quite as flattering.
Yeah, talking of which, I mean, after Crab Bites Wolf in Prague, George Monbiot wrote in The Guardian that Crab Bites Wolf was full of gratuitous violence and basically riot pornography. What have you got to say to that?
It's actually quite a funny story, because the reason Monbiot got to see the film was because this girl, I don't know what I should say her name, but she had made a film about the Quakers. And she'd taken the film to Monbiot, hoping that Monbiot would give her a quote to stick on the cover of it so she could promote it and maybe get it on the television. And, you know, and for some reason she took our film along to give him an example of the sort of flip side. So obviously the Quakers, the peaceniks, and I never actually saw her film. I'm sure it was great. and she was hoping that, I think, that Monbiot would then write about it in his weekly Guardian column. But he was so outraged by the film, the other film she showed him, which is our film, that he gave up. It was like May Day, I think, wasn't it? I remember reading it on a bus on the way up to the city. Where he was very excited. He got very upset. He said we were fetishizing violence and. Yeah, and he gave us, basically he gave us some great quotes.
Yeah, the sales rocket after that, didn't they? Yeah, did you get Monbiot's quote on the back cover for the second edition?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, Monbiot, he's, even today, he's still, I don't know. I mean, it's almost like, you know, I used to see Monbiot used to come to Reclaim the Streets meetings, and you'd see him at, you know, various gatherings and stuff, and he's getting involved in discussions, and it was quite ridiculous. He was like wanting to be a part of the resistance, but at the same time he was just using it for stuff that he could stick into his column and for his, you know, just so he could get the gen on people, and then he could peddle reformist dirge and slag them off. So
Which he's still doing
yeah,
now.
Yeah.
More to the point, there seemed a real social movement created around the world at the time. There was a lot of excitement about the anti-globalisation movement. And you had like the black blockers, the anarchists smashing up everything. It seemed like that was a continuation of J18 in this country, and it would go on forever and would build bigger and bigger. And I think after Seattle, there was a definite feeling that things on the move and so on. But it didn't happen. How do you think the anti-globalisation movement came to a halt or just dissipated or...
It's hard to tell. Yeah, I mean, I, along with a lot of other people, we were really excited about what was going on. In my lifetime, this was the most vibrant. I'm reluctant to use the term revolutionary, but it was the most vibrant, you know, progressive political situation that I'd been involved in, that I'd seen happening, and it sort of died a death. I guess the anti-war movement was part of it. I mean, it's sort of hard to tell. I think people got a bit lost chasing the summits. I think was probably, the politics sort of disappeared a little bit, and also, you know, it's all very well sort of closing down a summit here and there, but that's more of a gesture, and it wasn't picked up on. I mean, maybe just we weren't clever enough, or, you know, generally people didn't move forward, pick up on what was, okay, we've had some successes here, now we have to go into the communities and actually make the things that we're talking about happen, or at least get those messages across to people who aren't, you know, plugged into resistance politics like most people can't be arsed with. And fair enough, they're getting on with their day-to-day lives.
What about specifically the anarchist Black Bloc, who were film smashing things up and got blamed by a lot of people for alienating aspects of the movement? Then
I don't know really. A lot in the US, there are quite a few high profile arrests. People did some big jail time. Some of the guys from Eugene and that, got picked up on they'd done some local actions, and they got enormous, I can't remember, but long jail sentences. And I'm not saying that necessarily put people off, but
I think you get to a certain stage, don't you, like J18, when the violence gets quite widespread, then you're faced with the question of escalating the violence.
Well, exactly, and maybe that sort of people were possibly not organised enough, or actually had articulated the ideas in as much as where do we go from here. Mm. Yeah, I guess once you've broken a few windows, you've taken out some police cars and some banks, then what are you going to do next? What are you actually going to, you know, use that tactic to go forward? So are you going to start assassinating people, or are you going to try to formulate an army that's going to, take on the state in a confrontational way? And most people would go, well, you know, that isn't going to happen. It's not going to work like that. Or, we weren't on the verge of revolution either locally or globally.
And I guess one of the problems is that a lot of the activists, although some were homegrown, were sort of travelling around the world. So they were there for a week and had to go home. So they couldn't be setting up barricades and forming autonomous republics.
Because
they had to get the plane back. So that was always a problem. And then you went to Genoa, did you not?
And I guess Genoa was the sort of... It marked where it turned round, and we could see it sort of coming apart a little bit there. It's sort of the age-old problem in Genoa was that the organised left, who were very excited about the stuff that had been going on at the various summits and that, thought, right, well, we'll have some of this, and we're better than Italy for very established left-wing groups then to completely grasp... this movement and go, right, we're going to lay down a load of rules and we'll organise it. And, you know, and when we got to Genoa, there were some quite dreadful things that had already gone on. There was obviously huge deals had been made with the police about sort of various spectacles were going to be allowed to happen and other things weren't going to be allowed to happen. Guys possibly from the Tutti Bianchi or from some larger, Italian inverted commas anarchist groups, beating people up in the street. I saw a guy beaten up in the street because they were accusing him of being a cop, and they beat him up and then they left him in the march, and it was like, because they weren't really sure if he was a cop. Well, either he's not a cop and you leave him alone, or he is a cop and you kick him off the march. But I think there was a lot of confusion in that, and in that sort of...
And then there was the fatality of Carlo Giuliani. And then you were actually, I think you were in the school, which was attacked by police, but you left before they came, right?
Yeah, we were in the school and in the media centre there.
Can you just, maybe people don't know, just quickly explain them what the police did at the school?
There was like an independent media centre set up in a school in Genoa, and then there was a couple of days where there was a big action against the the G8 summit, and there had been some quite robust activity from the anarchists and or just from the activist blocs, and some really heavy-handed policing. I mean, the police had some ridiculous weapons. Like they were, you know, they were driving armour cars into crowds of people. They were flying helicopters low over the crowd and just shoveling tear gas canisters out the doors. You know, I remember sort of propping up some old woman in her 80s in a completely jam-packed crowd, holding a gas mask to her face, thinking this woman's going to die because it was like 35 degrees and there was like 10,000 people in a tiny street and there's just tear gas and cops driving this tank at the other end of the crowd. To sort of culminate it all, there was the police then turned up to this media centre and systematically beat the living daylights out of everyone they found there. And then the sort of press followed up with a bunch of stories about how, just like picking out individuals and smearing them.
I mean, it looked seriously heavy violence, wasn't it? I mean, people might have been killed, people were being carted out off to hospital. And
it was quite hard afterwards. It was very hard sort of keeping up on it. There was lots of people who had gone to Genoa from various cities. These guys, people who were like squatters who were sort of loosely affiliated with political groups went to Genoa and then never came home again, especially in it. A lot of Italians were, people went missing. And it wouldn't be, I don't think, too far-fetched to suggest that, the Italian police were...
So that must have been seriously scary. You must have been scared.
Yeah, it was sort of scary. It was...
Here, roughly...
Apart what's going to happen.
What's going to happen if you've got police like that out of control in a sort of political way that you just think, I could die here and no one will know.
Though there were a lot of people on the streets, yes, maybe, yeah. I mean, there were some sort of crazy things. But on the flip side of that, there were some quite inspiring things as well. I saw, now you go to a march in London, you see Palestinian flags, but there were Palestinian flags in Genoa worn by Palestinians who would appear from street corners and belt petrol bombs into police cars and stuff. And there was... there was various factions from Greece and Catalonia and whatnot. Maybe that was our opportunity, or before Jen was our opportunity to have some sort of communication or something to bring it all together and to be more coherent with it, and that didn't happen.
And really, do you think that the violence of the police there was, the death? Was such a shock to people that played a role in sort of ending that movement that people thought,
No, to be honest, I don't get that impression. I think maybe the reality is probably just a little more disappointing than that. Maybe people had just sort of thrown so much energy into something that then and they didn't know where to go next with it. I think the problem was as well. Then the anti-war movement. Then sort of, the whole sort of anti-capitalist movement then sort of almost unseen turned into this anti-war, this anti-war movement, which had massive left-wing groups being very influential in it. And I think maybe some of the more ad hoc or a lot of the individuals who had been involved up until then, because it was quite easy to plug into an anti-capitalist movement, then sort of got elbowed out. And then there was the great big marches, which was almost like the death knell for any kind of protest movement.
Had you gone to Genoa with the idea of making a film, a fourth in the film, or had you just gone to participate?
We didn't. I didn't even take a camera to Genoa, which, in itself... I mean, when we got there, there were sort of interesting things. I guess, part of my thing with activist filmmaking has always been, I think you really need to have a really good idea what you're doing before you pull a camera out of your bag, apart from anything else. And you're quite a menace if you're pointing a camera at people who are doing things that, they could get in a lot of trouble for. Then, you need to be really quite sure why you're doing it, and there needs to be a good reason for what you're doing it for, and you also need to be completely prepared to hold on to those tapes at any cost.
Yeah.
And I guess when we got to Genoa, we didn't really just want to redo anything that we'd done in the past. And we sort of discussed various ideas. What would we really like to do there? What could we do if we were doing some filmmaking? And then in the end, we just sort of really got stuck into what was going on there, really.
Let's move swiftly on your filmmaking career now. We had Phil Ruffin here a couple of weeks ago talking about the siege of Sydney Street. And I think you've made a short documentary about the Tottenham outrage, the robbery of the rubber factory in Tottenham in 1909. Can you tell us a bit about that?
That's right, yeah. Well, funnily enough, next year in January, it's going to be the centenary since this action happened. I guess, I'm presuming Phil Ruff spoke a lot about Sydney Street, and this was, it's just such a great story about a couple of young Latvian lads who carry out this ridiculously audacious robbery right outside Tottenham Police Station and then go on a 2-hour rampage through three London boroughs, chased by a mob of like 100 concerned citizens and policemen firing old Boer War rifles at them, and a football team join a chase, and they hijack a tram, and the cops...
And a party of duck shooters.
Yeah, and the duck shooters get stuck in, and it's just this really terrific story. So I made a sort of short documentary that... because it's just a story worth telling, isn't it? And I've just finished that recently, so hopefully we'll launch that possibly in January to coincide with the centenary, and maybe we could get some of our latest Eastern European comrades to reenact the outrage.
The real bank, I get your meaning, comrade. Yeah. And is that? I mean, you still got ideas for more films, or are you sort of abandoned the filmmaking?
I've not abandoned the filmmaking, in as much as I guess, with anything like writing or filmmaking, it's sort of you can walk away from it lots of times and go, actually, I just want to be a bloody carpenter. The stories are still there. I guess I've in the past couple of years, I made some short films, and at the minute I'm writing a feature script which is still overtly propaganda film. How would I pitch it to you, Ian? It's like a shit kicking story about a vibrant and valiant young Asian anarcho chick, and how the collective activity of the group is much more than the sum of its parts. It's like it's an anti-state propaganda film, and there's plenty of anti-state violence to keep even the most jaded, cinephobic class warrior happy.
What do you think of the current political situation? I mean, obviously things have been quite quiet. There's not been a lot happening, and now everyone's talking about the forthcoming recession, that people are going to be hit with jobs and home repossessions. I mean, do you think that's going to present new opportunities for sort of political anarchist movements to come out and maybe take new forms and new ideas of struggle?
Yeah, it would. I mean, I guess it's too glib to go, yeah, great, the banks collapse and we all collectivise in the streets around it. But it would be a pity if people didn't see the opportunities that are here. I mean, I guess when the house prices all collapse, and everybody who, was duped into buying into capitalism, and understandably so, who bought homes, they'll end up with debts that are bigger than their houses are worth, and people who can't afford to pay the rent, and the food prices are going up and stuff like this. Well, maybe actually, people will start thinking about, is this right? Can we keep going this way? Can we maybe collectivise a bit and look to each other to support us when the state has so quite obviously let us down? And also this idea of, you can do well. The dream is that you climb over your neighbour to get yourself into a more powerful, financially better position. Well, if that all comes apart, it would be nice to think that people might look to their neighbours and have some solidarity, in as much as, we're all stuffed together. I guess if there are house repossessions and evictions and people, you know, can't pay the rent, well, it'd be nice to think that maybe, you know, there's been a lot of house building, all the build to let brigade have built all these properties that they're not going to be able to let out. You know, if that's matched with a large number of homeless people, then, you know, I'd like to see the squatting movement take off again. There's no reason why that couldn't happen.
It'd be great to see the kind of squatting movement there was after the Second World War, where people who didn't have houses just moved into all the buy-to-let places.
I guess also, I mean, historically as well, sort of successful-ish anarchist groups, you know, I guess in recent history have done well, you know, in times of hardship, when if they can, you know, come along and go, well, actually, we can bring something to the situation that is useful to people. I mean, if that means, let's make shoplifting something that's socially more acceptable than it was. You know, if people want to storm the supermarkets and take all the food out and distribute in their neighbourhoods, I'm sure that will go down well with lots of people. I guess the opportunities are there, you know, especially within the activist anarchist movement. You know, half of these people have been in university for years, so they're, you know, they're quite well educated. So, you know, if your neighbours are having trouble with, you know, budgeting, or if they're having trouble with the banks or with the bailiffs, then, you know, you can help them out on both levels. That means you can help them out maybe possibly, you know, with the legalities, but then you can also turn up when the bailiffs come. If there's 30 people there, you know, waiting for the bailiffs, then the bailiffs are going to have to go away empty-handed.
You were at the, we've only got a few minutes left, you were at the Anarchist Book Fair yesterday. I noticed, I think you went to hear John Pilger, the journalist, speak, and also Newsnight's Paul Mason, taking time off for analysing the international. I mean, are we seeing a mass defection from the BBC and the Daily Mail and the ranks of journalism to anarchism? Is this something we can look forward to?
Well, it was interesting, actually, because, you know, of course, the Anarchist Book Fair, there was, like, you know, talks on, you know, the Mexican Revolution and whatnot. But it was interesting to see a few of these characters there. Pilger described himself as an anarchist. You know, fair enough, he was playing to the crowd a bit. But I thought he spoke well and was extreme enough to upset some of the more liberal elements in the room. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, interesting to hear what he said about how Barack Obama, that all he really offered was this return to the illusion that people have some sort of influence over geopolitics, you know, and as far as the world's concerned, nothing will change under Obama. You know, he was interesting. Paul Mason, you know, Newsnight economics editor, I really didn't know very much about him. He's a mine of information on syndicalist history, and he's just written this great book on working class struggle that I got a copy of yesterday, and I would, you know, encourage people to go and dig it out and read it.
We've got about 2 minutes left, so I'm going to ask you about your former life as an anarcho-punk, since, I guess, half the anarchists in the country came out of all those men in their 50s now, 40s, and we used to wear crass shirts on the back and all that.
Yeah.
Looking back on sort of crass anarcho-punk and that, what do you think of that now?
It's quite noisy, isn't it?
you can't hear the word. Go sing us a crass song live.
No, I don't want to sing you a crass song. Yeah, no, I'm, of course, like, you know, I guess a lot of people in my generation, you know, we were politicised. We were brought into it, you know, we were lured into it by Joe Strummer, and then we were, like, banged over the back of the head by Penny Rimbound. You know, and all stops in between, I guess, you know, if it wasn't for... I don't know. I guess we got Thatcher to thank, and she's gone mad, hasn't she? Like, if it wasn't for Thatcher, they probably we wouldn't have had something so iconic and poisonous to rally against. So we should thank the old bitch as we stick her in the ground, maybe. But
she's not been wheeled out this week to say you can't buck the market. I notice she's kept a bit quiet now. I think you're right. It was someone who was so horrible. It gives you a lot of power to organise. I mean, last question, really. Do you think music and film can actually aid political struggle? Do you think it can push things, or is it just a reflection of what's going on and can't really make much difference?
No, not at all, because I think it's something that draws people in, and it's, you know, it's that, oh, if it ain't my revolution, if I can't dance to it, it ain't my revolution sort of thing. And if, you know, it's great tunes, you know, sung by, you know, gorgeous girls in short skirts is always going to get people on side, isn't it? You know what I mean? Anarchist or otherwise.
Okay, that's brilliant, Simon. There's loads more questions I can ask you about, especially your career as a narco punk. But history
for the
may
next
not hear
time,
that.
Yeah.
Look forward to seeing your film on the Tottenham Outrage. That's the end of the show for this week. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.